Another week has flown by. It's Tuesday once again, and you know what that means. Time for the Parish of the Patriots, episode number 361. The road goes on and forever, and the party never ends. Having a great time. Glad you could join us this week. As always, looking forward to having hopefully an interesting, enlightening, thought-provoking, and hopefully entertaining discussion today. If you get something out of the show and you feel so compelled, don't be shy. Pay those tithes. We have snail mail. That's all we got. You can look on the description page for the show here in Radio Albion. There's the snail mail address. I don't think any further instructions are necessary. I mean, address an envelope. There it is. It doesn't get any more simple than that. And we do have a listener supporter mailbag this week, thankfully. The mail been running slow because, you know, we've had that, we've had some winter weather across the whole country. And, the post office is never known for being really timely anyway. So, I've still got Christmas cards coming in. Merry Christmas, Grandpa. That's from Hennick. I think I said that right. You know who you are. I do appreciate it. Nice card, by the way. Always appreciated. Let's see what else we've got here. Yes, we don't have just one. We've got two. GPD, more sporadic support from the unreliable supporter. Hope all is well. And big congratulations on holding Radio Albion together through the no spin era. That's no small accomplishment. Cheers until we meet again. And that is from Jackie. I tell you, I, for one, am so glad for the no Sven era to have come to a conclusion. It is great to have Sven back, and my workload is 6 million times less than what what it was before. And the level of content has obviously increased exponentially. So, yeah, it is great to have Sven back. And it's funny because, you know, we do the Daily National Show. Sven and I do the Daily National Show together on most Fridays. Did this past Friday. Had some stuff going on. And, you know, it's just the first show or two, it felt a little rough. And then it was just like right in the groove. You know, just like nothing ever happened. I had to be reminded periodically how long he was gone, because it, in a lot of ways, it seemed like it wasn't that long. And in other ways, it's kind of like being married, you know? It's kind of like being married. You know, you ask somebody that's married and it would be like, you know, on the one hand, they'll say, it seems like only yesterday you were saying your vows. And then on the other hand, it seems like it's been forever. It's like that. That's how Sven being gone is. It's like being married. And on one hand, it seemed like it took forever. It was just drug on forever till he got back. But on the other hand, it seemed like it actually wasn't that long. All at the same time. I don't know. Don't know what people might think about comparing being thrown in prison to being married. But there you go. There you have it. Of course, we got all kinds of stuff going on. I've got things jotted down. And as we continue with the new version of the show, where I just kind of mix in Christian specific stuff along with whatever else I want to talk about in whatever order. It's not chaos. There's a method to the madness. And I, for one, am enjoying doing it this way a lot more. And hopefully y'all are getting something out of it, too. Now, as you know, 99.9% of the time I record this show several days in advance. And this time is no exception. I'm recording this show on Saturday. And because I do it this way, I usually try, except in general terms, I try to stay away from current event topics. You know, I can talk about them in general, but, you know, obviously if you're recording this on Saturday, the show airs on Tuesday. It's not like I can do, you know, breaking news, this just in. And it's always risky because something could, a whole turn of events could happen. And then, you know, when the show airs, I look stupid. Like, you know, because people listen to the show, you visualize it like, you know, the host is there talking right now, only I recorded it on Saturday, and be like, this guy has no clue what's going on. A lot has happened since then. So I have to steer away from that, which makes it that much more difficult. We're on episode 361. You imagine 361 plus hours of finding something to talk about. I mean, back in the day, people would, you know, people be like, you know, I'm thinking about starting a podcast. And I'd be like, you'd be surprised how quick you will run out of stuff to talk about. It could be very tough. Only, you know, you gotta be able to stay with it and try to find new things to talk about. But anyway, what I'm getting to is, yeah, it is hard to talk about current events, except in the context of, you know, general things that you can be pretty confident about. And in that, going about it that way, I can talk about these current events. And of course, we'll talk about some of the things going on. One of the big stories here in the U.S. is this news anchor lady, you know, her mom got kidnapped. Samantha Guthrie, and her mom got kidnapped. And again, this is an ongoing thing. As of the recording of this show, I kind of checked on my phone real quick, just a quick skim of my phone. And it doesn't look like any new developments as far as I can see. But this story is, I've said this before and I'll say it again. These narratives are kind of like prophecy. You don't know where they're going for sure. You have to look at them in hindsight. But there is a narrative being built around this story. And see, this is how I can get into this, because we're talking about a general concept here versus the latest events, because obviously the latest events would be quite stale because I'm recording this on Saturday. There is a narrative here, and I don't know where they're going with it. And some people I've seen, or some people on the internet have seen, that this is a narrative being built as well. But I always see people get bogged down in the why, you know. This is a distraction from the Epstein. This is a distraction from the Epstein thing. See, it's a mistake to get into the why, because we don't know the why. I think what's important is what you can see. And there's a narrative being constructed. I was thinking about this the other day because the news was all aghast. You know, this is the big thing. And they're writing a story. These are script writers. You think of everything in the news as no different than a TV show, as a movie. And they write these scripts. And this is obviously a script being written around this story. Now, I'm not saying she's not really kidnapped. I'm not saying nothing's really happened. I'm not saying there's crisis actors. But what I am saying is, when you watch your TV news and they're going on about any story, really, a lot of stories, but this one in particular we're talking about, they are obviously writing a narrative. And there's several flags of this. There's several things that make this obvious to me. And we'll wade off into that today for our, you know, as we get off into our discussion. And honestly, for me, one of the first things that really raised a flag for me was when they came out, you know, because at first they were like, well, we saw things that made us believe this is a crime scene. And then they went from that to straight on, she was kidnapped. She was abducted. Now, the kidnapping thing to me was the first huge red flag. This is not the 1930s. It's not the 1960s. This is current year. And kidnapping, really, let's think about what this means. Imagine, because see, I can imagine things. Doesn't mean I have any intention of doing them, but I can imagine them. You know, and I can sit here and put myself in somebody's shoes and say, if you were going to kidnap somebody, you've got this brilliant idea that it's the 1930s or the 1940s, and you're going to go kidnap some news anchor's mom. I'm sure a news anchor like Samantha Guthrie gets paid decent, but I mean, she's not Jeff Bezos. You're going to kidnap a news anchor's mom. Well, the idea is stupid, but let's just roll with it and pretend this is our plot. Now you have to start working this through. And, you know, because we live in a society. We live in a surveillance state. You know, just with the flock cameras, and I've brought up flock cameras before. There's a website, it's like flock.me or something like that. I don't remember off the top of my head, but you have to search for it. It won't come up really on Google. You have to hunt and peck around, but you can find it. And it'll show where, give you an idea of how many of these flock cameras are around. I do not live in a metropolitan area, and they're everywhere. And once you start looking, you can find one of these maps and then, you know, look at your town, wherever you live. I would virtually guarantee there are flock cameras there. And you go drive and look, and yep, there they are, zip tied to a pole or what. These damn things are everywhere. They, isn't it funny? They just kind of appeared overnight. You know, it was like one day they weren't there. Next day they are. I remember when I first saw them, I didn't even have any idea where they were, what they were. And I thought, well, you know, the highway department's probably, you know, checking traffic to determine, you know, when they're going to need to repave the road or something. Then it dawned on me they never repaved the road. So that can't be it. Then I found out they were flock capers and they're all over. So here's your first problem. You're going to kidnap somebody. You have flock cameras everywhere. Multiple private residences have security cameras all over them. A lot of people do. Not just these doorbell cameras. People got security cameras hanging all over the side of their house. Businesses have security cameras everywhere. The idea that you're going to pull this off and not be picked up on surveillance video is pretty nonsensical. Now, granted, I suppose if the person in question really lived by themselves on a remote place way out in the middle of nowhere, yeah, you could probably pull this off. But from what I've seen, this lady lived in basically a suburb of Tucson, I believe it is, in Arizona. So she's not living out in the boondocks somewhere, you know, roughing it. Living the hermit lifestyle, off the grid. No, this was very much on the grid. And there's surveillance everywhere. Again, you work it through your mind. And to do what? What is the point of a kidnapping? You would do better off if you're just... Because here's the thing you run into on this. It can't... If this is a kidnapping, it's a sophisticated operation because of nothing else, just because of the amount of surveillance that you've got to be able to dodge and get around. This is not some low-level criminal. Because a low-level criminal, look, money-wise, payoff-wise, it would make more sense to kick the old lady's doors in, tie her up, and steal her jewelry and any cash that's in the house, which most people don't have any cash in their house. But, you know, she probably has some jewelry or something like that. Regular low-level criminals are going to kick in the door, tie the old lady up, and steal jewelry, and then take off and do it within, like, you know, the whole thing taking like 10, 15, maybe 30 minutes at the outside most, and then they're gone. Kidnapping, on the other hand, you there's so much you got to have in place. You're going to have a car, because now you're not going in, grabbing, stuffing a bag full of jewelry and taking off running so that you could park your car 3 miles out in the desert and go grab it there away from surveillance. You're hauling a person who, even though they're really old, they're still going to be resisting. Even if they just make themselves dead weight, you're hauling a person. This is a difficult thing to do. You're not going to be able to take off running through the desert 4 miles or whatever. So you got to have a car. You got to have a car nearby. This happens in the middle of the night. Guess what that means? That means there's a whole lot less traffic on the road, which means it's going to be a whole lot easier for investigators to look at the flock cameras and the different surveillance. Yeah, there might be a dozen cars. That's nothing. A dozen cars, they can go through there and start picking out, okay, who out of these dozen cars, who's who, why were they going through there? And they can pretty quick process of elimination figure out who was just, you know, works a midnight shift and was going home or whatever. And who is it? And again, for what? What are you going to ask for? $1 million ransom? Once if you kicked in the door, tied up the old lady, stole her jewelry, the local sheriff's department is going to do a half-ass investigation and say, well, you know, file it on your insurance and that'll be that. The minute you do kidnapping, the FBI is involved. Now you've got the feds involved. That brings up a whole new level. If you targeted this person, how are you going to know where they live unless you just by coincidence know? If not, you had to what? Search it up on the internet. Which means they're going to find that. Don't think they're not. I mean, how many people in the United States before this happened, before it occurred, just decided, you know what, this news anchor on TV, I wonder who her mom is and where she lives. They could find that. And they can quickly find out who searched it and track them down. For, again, for what? What is the payoff amount is going to be? In other words, look, I'm not a super smart person. I don't, I joke about these things and stuff, but really, honestly, I'm just a mid-tier regular person. And I can run through these things in my mind and see that the juice is not going to be worth the squeeze. This is a morality question. Obviously, I would never take part in kidnapping somebody, but I can put myself in their shoes and think it through and think, okay, if I was going to do this, what all would I have to take into consideration? And being not a super intelligent person, just a regular average guy, I can quickly run into a whole lot of things that means this isn't common. This is why you don't hear about this. Back in the day, you know, like the 30s, 40s, even 50s, 60s, 70s, you didn't have this massive surveillance state. And yeah, you could pull off a kidnapping. I can sit here and run through my mind and see really quick. And again, it's not like you're asked for $1 billion in cryptocurrency. This is a news anchor's mom. You know, at the most, what, $1 million? That's you can ask for that, I guess. And they're going to find you. You know, what are you going to do? There's no ransom drop you're going to do that there can't, you know, it's not, again, it's not back in the day. Where, you know, make sure there's no coppers around. And, you know, you've got, of course, the police around and they're wearing a trench coat, pretending to be a guy sitting on the bench, reading a newspaper, looking over there at the drop, see who comes to pick up the money. I can sit here and watch it on satellite. There'd be nobody within miles. They're just watching you on a satellite. Again, regular intelligent person. I can run through all of these things and I can quickly see where it would be more as far as just strictly cost benefit to break into the lady's house and steal her jewelry and take off. You know, that would less risk. Yeah, you're not going to get as big a payoff, but there's a whole lot less risk involved than in this kidnapping plot. And I know what you're thinking, but GPD, they're going to ask for cash. They're going to ask for cryptocurrency. Monero. Look, I mean, okay, how are they going to ask for it? Are they going to send an email? You know, at some point in time, they have to communicate their demands. Look, all of that stuff, if you believed that, and here's where the contradiction comes in. If you really believed that you're going to search up where this lady lives, who she is, where she lives, and they're not going to find it because, you know, I'm using a VPN. Trust me, if the feds want to find you, your VPN don't mean shit. Your VPN is fine as far as you don't want other people looking at your IP address and figuring out who you are. That's fine. But trust me, if the federales want to find out who you are, your VPN ain't going to do squat. It's not like they sit around and they have to be watching everybody's search histories. When they get into this, people will be like, well, they're not watching everything you search. This is true, but it is being cataloged so they can go back. You know, if you're looking up, don't panic. Hopefully you're not, but don't panic if you're sitting there looking up, I don't know, German foot fetish scat porn on your computer. It's cataloged somewhere. No one's probably going to look, but if they did, they could. But if you were looking up 2 days before, who is Samantha Guthrie's mom and where does she live? I can 100% guarantee you they know who you are right now. Hopefully you weren't just looking that up for some innocent reason because you've already gotten a knock on the door. That's just the reality. That's just the reality. And the contradiction comes in because if I know this, a really smart person is going to know this. This, if she's kidnapped, and again, I'm not saying she's not, if she's kidnapped, and we're, as of recording this, I think six, seven days into this kidnapping, and they haven't caught the people yet, that means this was a sophisticated operation being pulled off by smart people. So if I can sit here and run through this in my head, the smart people are about four steps further ahead than that. Which means the whole thing doesn't make any sense. You feel what I'm saying? It's there's something else. And narratives, like I said, are something like prophecy, like biblical prophecy or whatever. They have to be understood in hindsight most of the time. You got to understand, you really don't come to understand them until you look at them in hindsight. Now, when you realize all of this stuff is written like a movie script. And like recently, Samantha Guthrie and her siblings, you know, they did a video, a tearful plea for their mother's return. You know, I want to be clear. I'm not saying they're faking it and they're in on it or anything like that. There's a very good chance they have no clue. But when you understand all these things with the way they're presented to the public, it's written like a script. See, what we're in right now is the moment of this recording. This is the emotional buildup. You've watched enough movies. When you have a plot line, what do? They do a buildup, right? They do an emotional buildup. The hero is getting closer to saving the heroine, you know, to saving the love interest. He's getting closer. He's fighting his way through the armed security and zip lining down and crashing through the window. They're building the emotion up. We've had the tearful pleas on TV and the breath and the news anchors appear and they do solemn music for their intro instead of their usual trumpet blowing. And they say, another solemn day. We still haven't found this woman. They're doing the emotional buildup until the shoe drops, until the other shoe drops, and they tell us what happened. Everybody's supposed to be waiting with bated breath. They're working so hard to get people emotionally invested in this story. And so many people do. You know, I don't understand that, by the way. I don't understand why people get emotionally invested in a story about someone they don't know. You know, I don't know this one. I feel sorry, you know, for her family. You know, it's like when you hear about some random person dying tragically, you say, well, that's sad, but you don't personally get emotionally invested in the sadness because you didn't know who they are. You know, I'm not emotionally invested in this story. I have no idea who this lady is. You know, I vaguely know who her daughter is. Just, you know, oh, yeah, that's that lady on that one news show. But I don't give a shit. You know, I don't mean to sound cruel. And you're cruel and I don't care. No, I. It's actually the opposite. I acknowledge that I don't know this person, so I have no emotional capital in it. Her family has emotional capital. They're in the middle of it. Not me. I have no part of it. But so many people, they get emotionally invested in this. And the media narrative writing, the targeting is geared towards that. You're supposed to be emotionally invested in it. Why? So when they drop the other shoe, you're devastated or you're, oh my gosh, it's a miracle, or wherever they're going with the story. We don't know what to see how the story plays. It's like watching a movie. I view most news stories like this as you're just watching a movie. And it's scripted. I want to say it one more time. I'm not saying like, you know, Samantha Guthrie and her siblings are in on it and they're just faking it for the TV. I'm not claiming that. I have no knowledge of that. You know, again, I'm not even floating that out there. What I'm saying though is the narrative being presented on the TV for you is scripted. When a sufficient amount of emotional buildup has taken place, then we're going to have the climax of the story. And I don't know what that's going to be. I don't know. And I refuse to get bogged down into the why. Because I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows. But they are building a narrative around, you know, around this story. But the kidnapping thing itself, I just thought was really weird. You know, would you kidnap for what purpose? How much money are you going to ask for the return of an 84-year-old mother of a news anchor? Well, like I say, it's not like you kidnapped Jeff Bezos' wife or something. You're going to ask for $1 billion. I mean, how much money are you going to be able to ask for this old lady? And how are you going to get it? There's just so many problems with that. And people just, you know, I'm saying people in general, they just suck it up. They eat this stuff up. They view it like a TV show. They just suck it in and, oh my gosh, I'm emotionally invested in what's going to happen next. I don't know, man. you can see the red flags because we've witnessed so many of this, so much of this narrative building and these stories, news stories. So many times you can get where you just spot them right off the bat. You see what they're, we see what you're doing here, news media people. We see what, how this is being written up and they're doing the emotional buildup right now. Probably, I'm guessing that probably by the time the show airs, they will have reached the climax and they will be on to the next part of the story. And again, I think it's kind of useless to get too bogged down in the why. Later on, if you look at it in hindsight, sometimes you can know that you can figure out the whys. But at this stage, there's no need to get off in the weeds of the why thing. Of course, that doesn't stop people from doing it. One of the big whys I've seen out there that people throw down, this is a distraction. It's a distraction from the Epstein files. Because we have more Epstein stuff drop. Lots of emails from the Epstein stuff. And I gotta lie, there is some stuff that I find curious in there. We'll touch on that here in a minute. But, you know, do you see anybody panicking? You know? Do you see? This is... all these people involved in this. Look, I saw almost ridiculous talking about news media narratives. The other day, they dropped a narrative that Epstein was actually working for Russia and Putin. That has been, I mean, whoever came up with that idea to float that trial balloon out there must have been the same person that decided to pick the .30-06 caliber for the weapon that shot Charlie Kirk. I mean, it's really some amateur hour stuff because obviously this is a Mossad operation. You know, it's the Russians. It was Putin. Putin was talking about go back to the kidnapping for a minute. I thought, well, who's going to be revealed to be the villains behind it? You know, is it going to be white supremacists? That's kind of passe right now. I don't think it'll be that. It could be radical, you know, anti-Israel protesters from the left or something. Or maybe Iran. Then I thought maybe it was Venezuela. Now, that would be funny. I'm not making light of somebody's tragedy. But it would be a funny development in the narrative if it actually turned out the Venezuelans sent in a special ops team, kidnapped this lady, and they're going to trade her for Maduro. That would be funny. It's not going to be what happens, by the way. But you'll know sometimes by who the bad guys get identified as being. The Iranians did it. Oh, well, then we better start bombing them. Anyway, yeah, the Epstein stuff. They dropped this Epstein stuff. And the idea that these people actually are dropping information about themselves. You know, they dropped all these files. Now, remember, we had Trump and the whole Department of Justice spent a certain amount of time there for a while telling us that there were no files. Remember that? Remember when they were saying there are no files? Y'all don't understand. There are no files. There's nothing to even look at. And now they're dropping like millions, I don't know, tens of thousands of these files that they were just telling us didn't exist. See, they lie about everything. You know? They don't even care. No explanation of, wait a minute, I thought you said these files didn't even exist. And now you're dropping thousands of them? And the same people that said there were no files and now are dropping thousands of them also want us to believe that they're being 100% honest and giving us the actual files. And, you know, they drop stuff that's juicy enough to get people excited, you know, to hook them into the story. People going through these things and, oh my gosh, you know, here's a picture of them there, you know, looking really weird. Well, what you can take away from that, just imagine the shit they didn't bother releasing because they're not going to give you that. I mean, the idea that what they're releasing to the public is the stuff that they figure it's okay for you to look at. The real stuff is long gone. The real stuff is probably being stored on a server in the Mossad headquarters in Israel. Because we know that wasn't the Russians. I mean, this is obvious. a part of a Mossad operation. No, it's not blackmail. It wears me out when you have these people talking about, oh, yeah, it was a blackmail operation, not a blackmail operation. I've said this before, and I think I'm loath to repeat myself, but it's an important part. A blackmail operation is you don't know any better, and you say you're a married politician, and you're out at a convention, and this pretty woman comes up to you, and you think she's flirting with you, and one thing happens to another, and only pictures get taken, and then you get an envelope in the mail with the ransom note. It's like the kidnapping thing. You get an envelope in the mail with pictures of you and this attractive young woman, and they're like, you do what we want or give us money. Otherwise, these photos are going to the media. These photos are going to go to your wife. That's a blackmail operation. That's not what this was. This was, say you're a congressman and you want to become a senator, or you're a senator and you want to become the majority leader, or you want a spot on this committee. You want a position with more power and authority. You got to have collateral for that. The collateral is you go and partake in certain things which get documented so that those who hand out the power have collateral. They do everything as usury. It's just they do everything with banking. It's everything. And they want collateral. You put up the collateral. The collateral you put up for a position of power is something that could instantly destroy you if you ever decided to not follow orders any longer. So they go, and you willingly go. That's not blackmail. There's another term for it. You voluntarily go. They say, you're going to go. We'll fly you to our facility, and you're going to do X, Y, or Z horrific thing. I'm not going to even illustrate some of the stuff they were probably doing. But, you know, gay sex isn't going to be bad enough. Not in 2026. You know, going and cheating with a woman, not your wife, is not going to be enough. So it's going to have to be something pretty gross. And you go and you do this, and you know their document. It's not like someone's hiding a camera. You know they're documenting what you're doing. This is the collateral you're putting up so you can get that position of power. This is the way this worked. It's not blackmail. It's collateral. I said this going into this whole Trump thing. You know, I do think Trump's first time around was a glitch in the system. They really didn't think that many people were going to go out and vote for the guy. I mean, they took it lightly. They didn't do enough voter fraud, and he actually got in. And you could see the panic. I remember the way the news media was in a panic when it became obvious that he was winning and that he was going to win. They were in a fear panic. Now, this last election, I said this going into it, you know, he's working out a deal, and he worked out a deal. You know, he had to figure out, they had to work out some collateral, you know, and I don't think it was this sort of collateral. The other people, he's into Epstein, he did the Epstein thing. I think he was resistant to that sort of collateral. That's why it took him a long time to work out a deal. I said at the time, if all these charges against him instantly disappear, you know a deal got reached, and it did. He worked up, they settled on some collateral, and he was put into place. And then you watch this last time we got elected, and it became obvious he was going to win. The media wasn't in a panic. They were just like, oh, Donald Trump looks as though he is going to win the presidential election of the United States. They do everything in the context of usury. So you're going to have collateral for that power to make sure you're not going to go off on your own doing shit. Donald Trump has put up some sort of collateral. I don't think it was an Epstein-type collateral, but they have something on him that they're satisfied it'll keep him on the reservation. So they're allowed him to be president again. And it works out for them because some of the stuff he's putting into place would be hard for, you know, a Team D candidate to put forward. You know, plus he's built up a cult following and all of that. I'm getting kind of off the topic here. I want to reel it back in. The Epstein stuff they have released. You know, again, this is the... And yet people pearl-clutching on some of this, you know? Oh my gosh. These rich and powerful men were... They were having sexual intercourse with 17-year-old girls. I'm sorry. Is it going to offend some of y'all? But, you know, to be quite blunt, who gives a shit? Look, I'm old. And, you know, like when I was young, you know, everybody knew that, like, famous rock stars were banging teenage girls. I mean, that when you listen to that Bob Seger song, Turn the Page, and he says, you know, you think about the woman or the girl you knew the night before. Everybody knew, like, rock stars and stuff would be banging teenage girls. That would just, it wasn't this weird thing that we have now. I'm not making light of it, but when they say, look how crazy this Epstein stuff was. My gosh, these rich, powerful men were having sex with the 17-year-old. That's the crap they throw out to you. What was really going on there was way, 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 way worse. Now, as I started to say at the beginning of getting into this, there are still some things. I'm not going to sit here and say none of it's useful. There are some things that are in there that if you look for them, are interesting. Clues, if you were. That I do find interesting. And one of those things is there was this obsession with these DNA test kits. It's 23andMe. You look at who founded that company. Then it went bankrupt. Then the same person owns a nonprofit and buys it back. Same person running it. Let's just say, you know, same tribe. You know, so you can see why they're trusted here. But there was this, there are a lot of these emails, this communication stuff, and they're talking about sending all of these 23andMe DNA kits to these various people. Why? They weren't looking for their family answers. They were looking for something else. Why? And here's something else to think about. You know, it takes a minute to get that stuff back. You know, it's not like, oh, well, you know, we're having a party and this guy, he wants to do a DNA test on the, you know, this one young woman that he was with or something. I mean, it's going to take several weeks. So that means these people aren't going anywhere. You feel my drift. Got to find out who in the cage. They were looking for something. Here's my theory on this because it's the only thing I can think of that makes any sense. They're looking for something bloodline related. I don't know what. They're not testing, like, if you're foolish enough, and hopefully you're not, but if you're foolish enough to send your DNA to one of these things because you want to know their ancestry, they're giving you some just whatever, you know, slop that you'll, you know, so they can say they gave you something for your money. They're testing something. These people, these rich, powerful people, these celebrity people, these chosen people, and they're involved in all of this. They're getting this DNA tested for something else that you don't, normies don't get sending something into 23andMe. Again, the circumstantial evidence points to this because they were obsessed with sending these kits out, and they were sending multiples. We're sending, you know, six of these out. Why do you need six? And who are you using them on? And why are you confident that in the time it takes for the kit to arrive, to take the sample, send it back and wait several weeks for the results, that they're still going to be there? Apparently they can't go anywhere. It's my belief that they were looking for certain genetic markers for something, for some other thing. And then it turns out this guy, the Epstein, you know, he was also knee deep in with these geneticists, you know, some of these people involved in some pretty, you know, high tier stuff. And this gets into the transhumanism stuff. See, we're on a trajectory. We're going somewhere with this. Sorry about that. I keep bumping my microphone because I get flailing my hands around. It's the way I communicate. I could actually pull, if I had the looks for it, I could pull off video, except there probably wouldn't be a good video platform for me, but I flail my hands around when I talk. But unsurprisingly, Epstein, all of these people, always really deep into this whole transhumanism thing. He was big on it. You know what it is, and it's basically this idea that you're going to find a way to live forever. You know? I don't understand the mindset because, you know, I'm not, I don't know, an evil, wicked POS serving Satan. So, you know, can't, you know, I don't get it. I find it curious. It's an illogical position that these people have. They're obsessed with, you see it from the Klaus Schwabs and all of those, you know, World Economic Forum people and these rich and powerful people. Epstein himself was real big on it. And they're obsessed with this idea, this transhumanism idea. Like they're going to upload their brain. They're going to be able to hook their brain up and put it into a new body. They're going to live forever. This is so contrary to the Christian point of view. You know? I mean, because like, why? You know? Why? I mean, why the hell? And do what? You know, they're obsessed with the idea that they're going to live forever. You're just like, well, Danny, if you were rich and powerful like these people, you know, if you were a billionaire, tech oligarch or whatever the hell else, you too would want to live forever. And do what, though? I mean, really? And do what? You know, I've watched shows before, usually anime, and, you know, that deal with the concept of how boring immortality would actually be, you know, like with a, they'll have like a vampire character and they'll portray the character as essentially not this overwhelming evil entity or anything, but he's basically just really, really bored because he's lived long enough. He's seen all, there's nothing new under the sun and his life is just drudgery. That's what I would imagine it would be. They're not going to live forever, by the way. They're chasing a lie, but they do chase it nonetheless. But why? Look, I mean, because look, it's natural to be fearful of death. That's part of our survival instinct. You know, let me word that differently. Not necessarily fearful of death, but death is the unknown to an extent. I mean, because as believers, we have an idea. We have faith, and we know after we transition from this state of being into the next state of being, we're confident in our salvation in Jesus Christ. But it is still something new. I've used the illustration before. If I knew 100%, look, somebody was going to give me a lot of money and I could move to, I'm just pulling a random country out of the air. You know, you're going to live, we're going to give you $15 million and set you up with a beautiful estate and you're going to go live in Romania. Withhold your comments on Romania, whatever you think of Romania. I just grabbed that country out of the air. You know, I'm going to have an estate. I'm going to have all kinds of money and, a really nice life in Romania. Guaranteed. I would still be nervous about it because I don't know anything about Romania. Obviously, probably because I picked Romania. but it's still the unknown. You're still going to somewhere new. It is that way for us as believers. We have faith in Christ and our salvation, and we understand that we're going to be birthed from this life into the real life, and death is a certainty from this life, but it's the beginning of the true thing. This is the prequel we live through. We understand that, but we've still never been there. We've not been to the kingdom of God. We don't know how the actual details of how things work there and so on and so forth, what work we have to do. We know we're going to have work to do, but we don't know what that work is. Or, you know, hopefully we accomplish enough maturity in this life to where we can be of use to God in the kingdom of heaven. We know these things, but it's still the unknown. So, of course, it's scary. You know, we don't necessarily fear it, but it is the unknown. So we can't honestly say, we no sweat. But we do have a viewpoint that there's no reason for us to want to drag this on. In other words, as unsettling as the idea of the unknown, so, you know, how things are going to be then, that is nothing compared to the horrible I mean, to me, horrible idea of trying to somehow stay in this realm forever. That just sounds horrible to me. I don't understand what these people, well, I do, and I'll get to that here in a minute. Because they themselves probably don't acknowledge it to themselves. That's an instinctual thing. Okay, you're filthy rich. You have all of this power. And you want to live forever. And again, to do what? To get more money? To get more power? How many different forms of degenerate sex can you do? I mean, seriously. I mean, how much of that can you do and get anything out of? At some point in time, if you could live long enough, it's going to get boring. You know, you're going to get sick of it. But these people are obsessed with the idea that they're going to transplant their consciousness and live forever. The Christian mindset is one of we understand, this is wisdom and understanding. We live in a temporal realm created by God. We get X amount of time. We don't know how much time, but we do know it is finite. And so we cannot waste it. We have to try our best to avoid wasting time because every day that goes by, we can't get back. We spend it. We spend our time and we're not getting it back. So we try to use it to mature and get ready to be birthed into the real life. We have an understanding like that. We understand our role here. We understand why we're here. These people, these transhumanist type people, they've got everything so twisted. They don't even understand why they're here. They're wasting this time. This is where I think it gets to be an instinctual thing, because spiritually, there has to be a part of them that knows that all of this they have is a waste of time. They have squandered their time, and at some point in time, they're going to be called to account. The end is going to come, and everything that they have acquired in this life is going to be lost. Every man leaves this world the way he came in. The homeless person on the street or the most wealthy, powerful man in the world, they leave this world the same way. You know, I think there's an instinctual thing at work here where they understand in their heart of hearts. They probably, just guessing, they probably don't even acknowledge it to themselves because it's too frightening. But there's a part of them that is screaming that they have wasted their time. And as each day goes by and they get close to death, a lot of these are old guys, and you get more aware that the end is a whole lot closer than the beginning. And they're trying to cling to it and hold on to it because they're not getting it back. They've already solidified. This is the thing about spending your time. You're establishing who you are. You know, if you cumulatively, I'm not talking about individual decisions. I'm talking about cumulatively. When you get older and you look back at your life and because this is something when you get older, you look back. If you're a young person, let's say if you're 20 years old, your life is ahead of you and your decisions are going to set the course of your life. But when you get older, like my age, you're able to look back and say, okay, who am I? Well, you look at your life. I'm a Christian believer. I believe in Jesus. I my life, cumulatively speaking, has been one of seeking God, seeking to understand him, you know, to gain wisdom, knowledge, and understanding as much as I can in his purpose, what he's doing, and just at its essence, who he is. Cumulatively, I have screwed things up beyond belief. I have committed sin. I have done things I regret. But big picture, you know, it's kind of like talking about groups of people, say, whether you're talking about racial groups or whatever. You talk about the group, but you're not necessarily talking about, you know, each individual person you encounter from that group. It's like that. We're talking about cumulatively, what has your life been about? What has been your overarching theme, your goal in your life is to know the Lord. not talking about your individual decisions and you screwed up this time or that time or whatever, because everybody does that. Everybody is committed sin. So we're talking about, but overall, what has been your overall goal? Is seeking the Lord. And that becomes who you are. That becomes your name, if you would. And when Jesus was asked, who are you? I'm the way, the truth, and life. It becomes who you are. That's why living longer or reincarnation is silly. You've already established who you are. If your memories got reset, you got a slate, you got your brain wiped clean and reincarnated and did it all over again, you're still who you are and you're going to do the same things. Your life is going to amount to the same thing because that's who you are. I mean, sure, details might be different because maybe in your reincarnation, you were, you know, raised in a different environment or a different time. So you might have some different views, but at the core essence, it's who you are. The who you are part doesn't change. So over the span of your lifetime, you've established who you are. This is who you are. With all your faults and everything else, this is who you are. This is what you decided to prioritize. You are who you are, and it's not getting undone. These people, they've also established who they are and who they serve. And there's no undoing that. Now, one of my thoughts on this, and without, this is just the way I view it. I'm not, because I think I have a theory. Let me put it this way. I'll get it spit out. I have a theory on this. Because you see, I believe, and I think this is a sound belief, that one of the things that really defines where we're at now versus where we're going is time. Time is what this world is, the essence of this realm that we exist in, that God created. Time. This is the defining thing, not whether the earth is round, flat. The defining thing of this realm we live in is time itself. This is what constrains us, and what holds us in this realm are these physical bodies that we move around in. That's what holds us. That's why when we die, we leave this realm, because the thing that anchors us here is it shuts down. God, I believe God, the kingdom of heaven, the spiritual realm, if you were, when we leave this world, we leave time behind, so time doesn't exist in the way it exists here. I don't understand the details and whatnot, but I do believe, I believe it's a sound belief, that God exists outside of time. And when we leave this world, we exist outside of time. I probably told this story before. I remember reading a thing one time way back. I was like a kid, and they used to put these little snippets in the article and newspaper. And when, Billy Graham, who Billy Graham is. And, he had a snippet in there where he would answer people's questions. And somebody wrote in a deal. And again, I was a kid back then, talking about people that have these near death experiences. And they see things, and come back. They die on the operating table and they come back. And this person was relaying a thing where, they were asking Billy Graham what he sees, what his thoughts on this were. And his response was, it's malarkey. And his reasoning was that there's been instances to where people claim to have seen this thing, and they died, and they said that they saw all these people, their loved ones there. But some of the people they saw were actually still alive. So based on that, Billy Graham said, this is just some illusion in your brain. I find this curious because this guy, of course, he's dead now, but he was in the Protestant world, one of the big, big spiritual authorities, if you would. And I remember that, and it's telling to me because from my viewpoint, he didn't have a clue. Now, I don't know if the people that come back and have these near-death experiences, you know, I don't know how much of that is sound and how much is not. But to base it, to dismiss it, because, well, they came back and said they saw, you know, Aunt Mabel there, and Aunt Mabel's not dead. So it's impossible. It can't be real. But that's to misunderstand, because if God exists, and thus we will exist outside of time when we die, then of course you could see people that haven't, from the temporal viewpoint, haven't died yet. Because when they die, they're outside of time too. So yeah, they could meet you there. And it just struck me that this guy didn't have a clue. He might have been basically the Protestant Pope at the time, but he didn't have a damn clue. Again, that's not to say that stuff is legit or not. That's beside the point. But to dismiss it on the grounds of, well, it can't be real because you couldn't see somebody hadn't died yet. Well, yeah, you can. Because when you die, you exist outside of time. So, yeah, you can. Now, to get back to the point of my theory on this, I think some of the panic, because you see, if when you die, you can exist outside of time. Hear me out here. For these wicked, transhumanist, evil, asshole people, for these servants of Satan that sell their soul for some money and some power and to, you know, do these things, I think some of this panic is because, you know, I said it's instinctual, but you see, if when we leave this plane of existence and we're outside of time, then theoretically, in my mind, that means that while they're still here, indulging in this, and they can't do any different because this, they can't do any different because that's who they are. Not because God or anybody else is interfering with their free will, but because at this point they've established that's who they are. You know, that you can't change who somebody is. You know, that's why you look in the Bible, or you understand the history of the apostles or different saints throughout history, and a lot of them died in really horrific ways, and they would grab these guys and put them in prison and torture them like they're going to somehow make them with something they're not. But that person has already established who they are. No matter how much you torture them and try to make them say anything, and you haven't changed the fact that that's who that person is. You can't change that. Does that make sense? Because they've accumulated this trajectory in their life. You grab them off the street and go torture them till they're barely conscious and try to make them mutter something that you can say, ha ha, he's renounced the faith. You haven't changed anything. That person's life has been established who they are. Like God doesn't know. You just tortured them and put drugs in their system to make them mutter something. Now you're trying to accuse them. That is who they are. These people are who they are. They can't help it now because that's, they've established by their own decision making who they are. The point being, and I have this belief, if we exist outside of time when we leave this realm, and I do believe that, then even as they are here, continuing to do what they do on the trajectory that they're on, simultaneously, hear me out now, simultaneously, they're already in hell. If we exist outside of time when we leave this world, think about that. Imagine you're one of these guys. You squandered your time chasing money, power, serving the devil. It's over. You leave time. Only you leave time not to go be with God. You leave time to go to eternal punishment. And you're there spiritually in torment, in hell, aware that in the temporal realm, actually, there is a part of you still making those decisions. You probably would wish you could reach out through the darkness and grab yourself and say, stop. Only, even if you could do that, which you can't, you know it would be futile because you yourself would know that you wouldn't stop. It's like the story Jesus told about Lazarus the beggar and the rich man. And the rich man in torment says, well, we'll send him back. And Abraham says, well, he's got Moses and the prophets. I mean, your brothers understand. They can make their own decision. He says, no, but if that's not enough. But if they see this guy come back from the dead, then they'll believe it. To which he says, no, they won't. In other words, they are who they are. It doesn't matter what they see. They've already established who they are. I think maybe that's where some of this comes from. You know, this instinctual obsession with trying to live forever is because outside of time, in a sense, they're already in hell. A part of them, they're spiritually outside of time, they're already in hell. And part of that torture, a part of that punishment in hell is knowing that in the temporal realm, they're there making the exact same decisions, doing the exact same thing, and nothing, even if they themselves could reach out and come to themselves in a dream and say, stop, they won't, and they know they won't. I have a theory that this is where some of this obsession with, you know, transhumanism and trying to live forever comes from. It's spiritually based because depending on how you look at it, they're already in hell. We're going to wrap up on that note. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Hope you enjoyed the discussion. Hope you enjoy the rest of your week. And of course, as always, I hope I'll see you here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.